You are tuned to CFRO, Vancouver's Cooperative Radio, 102.7 FM, listener-sponsored radio in Western Canada. And coming up right now is Animal Voices.
Lies in the wisdom and understanding of one's role in the great mystery and in honoring every living thing as a teacher. It's a quote from James Sand and David Carson. Think how different the world would be if we appreciated all the species for their contribution to the world rather than regarding species other than human as inferior and exploiting them for our own purposes. Welcome to Animal Voices, the program dedicated to developing appreciation and compassion for all creatures. My name is Marge Adams. In the studio with me are co-hosts Carl Loskin and John Pranger, and technician Alan Jensen. We have possibly three guests. We know we have two today on the line for the next hour. And one of them is Julia Izaskis, sorry, I have to follow up that name. Julia is with co-owner of Pause in Motion. And we also have a guest, Oksana, from Seduced Vegetarian Restaurant on West 4th Avenue in Vancouver, and Emily Doyle Yamaguchi from the faculty of food systems at University of British Columbia, and she has been a participant in the World Urban Festival, which took place this week in Vancouver. We also will have some music from our technician, Alan Jensen, and Carl Loskin has many items of interest and an interview, perhaps two interviews. Now, could we get Julia on the line? Good. Hi, Julia.
Hi, Mark. How are you?
Oh, I'm fine, thank you. Julia, I know that Pause in Motion has moved recently to a new location in the Kitsilano District, and tell us why, will you?
Well, I just bought into the company around December, the one that just passed, because the space that Pause in Motion was operating in, they were going to tear it down. And my partner, Sue McCarthy, had to find a new space, but also it gave her an opportunity to take the growth of the company just a step further. And so we decided to move to Cornwall in a way of, like, housing and umbrellaing all the different stuff we want to do with animal health, nutrition, and animal welfare.
Oh, wow. So you are expanding your program quite a bit, aren't you?
We are, from doggy daycare for sure.
Now, I know you have walking service and you have a daycare and even boarding, but can you tell us a little bit maybe about each of those?
Absolutely. You know, I like to think of our daycare as being really quite unique because it's not just about industry. We really, really care about the animals. We want to make sure that each animal is unique, their temperament, their energetic level, their age, all of that. And we have, we offer a specific kind of tailor-made for your dog service. It's a personalized service. So we offer the service of picking up and dropping off your dog and taking them on 4-hour off-leash dog hikes to the mountain if your dog is good off-leash, and beach hikes for 3 hours off-leash. We offer 2-hour on-leash hikes, 1-hour on-leash hikes. We just recently started having puppy training because we were finding that some people were just getting dogs and leaving them at daycare and not having the time to train them properly, and we wanted we didn't want our place to be one of those places where the dogs were learning bad habits. We wanted it to be somewhere like really positive, where positive reinforcement was going. So when the puppies went home and the dogs went home, they were a better dog.
So you actually train them if they are in daycare?
Yeah. If there's a new puppy, we talk about doing training, and then we'll go outside of the, you know, working hours and meet with the owner and the puppy and do one-on-one training as well. Just to make sure that, you know, I mean, owners that don't have, like, first-time puppy owners really don't, are sometimes are overwhelmed, and it's always really nice to have, like, give them some guidance there. But just let me mention that thing about what we do is that I think some people have the fallacy that, oh, the dog would be much better off at daycare all the day, they feel guilty, all that kind of thing. What we do with our personalized daycare is that we look at the dog and see whether or not he's getting more anxious by being in the daycare, or he's benefiting from it. Because some dogs will go on a four-hour hike and they need to rest rather than be in the daycare where all the dogs are running around and having fun. So we personalize it to each dog.
So you would do, some dogs would prefer to be picked up and walked.
Yeah,
and
you go
hiked
home and eat
back.
And sleep.
Sure, I see, where it's quiet.
Rather than be just like completely like playing nonstop, and then they get home and then they don't even move. Right? And it's like, you know, for dogs that are getting a bit older, that's not necessarily the best thing for them. Or dogs that have anxiety issues or are pretty hypertense dogs, to try and keep them at that high level isn't really good for them. So what we really do is that we'll talk to the owner about what we've seen in the dog's temperament and what we really think the best thing for the dog is.
And when you go on these hikes, how many dogs will you take at a time?
Well, we were taking 8 before because that was what the legal maximum allowable number was, but now they're changing it to 6, so that's no problem. We're doing 6 dogs on the mountains, and before a dog goes on the off-leash hikes, we test them out. You know, we need to make sure that they can come on command and they're going to stay with the pack. They're not like little rogues that are going to run off, because the safety of the dog comes above and beyond anything.
Right. Now, and you do have your own dogs, too. I know that Susan used to use her dog as a herding dog.
Well, Mosey, Susan's dog, is actually what inspired her to start Paws in Motion. She was taking Mosey out all the time and was just seeing how much his temperament and his behavior and everything was benefiting from the amazing exercise by being out there. And then she just started taking dogs on, and it's just, you know, with dogs are physical creatures, right? So being on a leash and confined all the time, you know, unfortunately they have to do that to live within society and, you know, for them to live safely within society. But sometimes it's just great, you know, where they can just run with us and, like, go on the hikes and sniff where they want to be and not be pulled. And it's just one of the most beautiful services I think we offer.
Mm-hmm. I bet the dogs love it. They probably get all excited. Yeah. Now, you also have a feeding program that's rather important, I know.
Yeah, well, I'm into homeopathy. I've been studying homeopathy, and I got into homeopathy because I took my dogs to a homeopathic animal caregiver, and I wasn't happy with traditional veterinarian. I mean, surgical veterinarian stuff is amazing, but I didn't really believe in vaccines, or I just saw my dogs that I had before were always sick, and I was always taking them to the vet, and they had, you know, they had anal gland problems and skin problems and immune problems and all this stuff, and I did a lot of research, and I found that raw food is one of the most amazing things you can do for your dog's health and to keep him out of the vet and keeping the bills down. And Sue has just started her raw food when I kind of came on board, and we both really wanted to educate people on how amazing raw food is for the dogs and really the health benefits. And I could go on, honestly, for the rest of the time we have about how raw food makes an animal healthy so they don't have to go to the vet. Because there's a lot of things that dogs go to the vet for because they think it's normal, but it's not normal. It's only because the dog isn't in a healthy condition that they have all of these, like, kind of like sickly diseases going on. But if a dog has a healthy immune system and is eating properly, its body should be able to take care of everything. And I can tell you, my dog, 6 years, no problems whatsoever. So we really like to educate people about all the benefits.
Do you feed them exclusively raw food?
Yes, exclusively raw food, and sometimes we give them dehydrated liver treats, and we give them raw bones. I know everybody's like, oh no, don't give dogs raw bones, but actually raw bones are softer than cooked bones, and that's why you give them raw bones, because cooked bones splinter and can like splinter in their mouth and hurt their stomachs and all that. But raw bones are so easily digestible, and they get their calcium and they get their minerals, and it's just the best thing for them.
You just serve them like big bones. What about something like chicken bones? Would they
actually? Part of the raw food diet is we give full chicken carcasses sometimes because chicken bones are so soft. They actually keep the teeth clean, and they're easy to eat. And the thing is, you don't keep the way it works is the food is frozen just to ward off bacteria. This is really important. You can't just, like, give your dog, like, minced meat or something like that. It's like the food is frozen. It's packaged in a human grade, sometimes better human grade. It's, like, antibiotic, hormone-free. And its package is frozen, and you have to keep it frozen the whole time you have it. And then the night before, if you're going to feed them in the morning or the morning of the day you're going to feed them, you thaw it out. And once it's thawed, that's when you feed them. So there hasn't been time for any bacteria to build. And you put salmon oil in there for the essential fatty acids for their joints and their coats, and you put some bone meal in there because the bone meal, like I said, if you're not eating bones or carcasses, the bone meal is really good for their anal glands. Because just to tell you about that, the stool in an animal that's in the wild, they eat the bones, they eat the everything, and the animal's body has a natural way of cleansing itself. So when it's going to the bathroom, the stool is quite hard because of the bone meal and because of the bones, that it's naturally cleansing the colon while the dog is going to the bathroom. But with regular dog food that's so mushy and full of wheat and stuff, it's not giving the proper stimulation and like excreting the buildup of bad bacteria that the animal should be getting.
I see. Now, I know that you and Susan are both concerned about animal rights, and that's in your future, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Well, our first thing right now, I mean, we've been so busy just trying to, you know, get set up in our new place and get ready for our grand opening in September and make sure that all our customers that have been loyal to us for the past, 6 to 7 years are taken care of, that our services are great. So right now we're focusing on streamlining our inner structure, but we want to umbrella into a nonprofit kind of organization to take care of to start addressing animal rights and animal cruelty and what's going on with the explosion of like this trendiness to have animals. But a lot of people don't really understand what it means to have an animal, and we're finding a lot of 2 or 3 year old dogs being surrendered because, the puppy stage has grown out and no one took the time and effort to teach the dog anything, and they become frustrated and they just abandon him.
Right. Now, along that same line, you're going to be working with homeless youth, aren't you?
There's a gentleman out there, and I'm sorry, I don't have the organization's name. I mean, if you call Paws in Motion, I'm sure they have it. We'll have it there. But Sue has been primarily dealing with this, but we've agreed and actually been willing and wanting to be part of this program because youths on the street that have animals, you know how sometimes you see homeless kids and they've got dogs?
Yes.
Cats, right? They have an 80% greater chance of rehabilitation into society. So this man is going and like contacting, all the young homeless kids that have animals, and it's about a program of setting them up in businesses where they learn a skill, they get to do something they like, and then eventually they'll be employable. So it's a way of reintegrating them back into society.
I see. That's wonderful.
Yeah, we're really excited about it.
Yeah, and they'll be serving the dogs, and the dogs will be serving them, won't
yeah.
they?
Yeah, and they'll be happy. I think that's a beautiful, animals have shown that, they heal with their love. And, we feel their love when we have them, and, it just extends there, so.
Sounds wonderful. Well, thank you so much, Julie. It's really interesting hearing about your business.
Was I talking too much?
No, most interesting. But give us a couple of contact, your website and your phone number, will you, so people can get in touch with Paws in Motion if they'd like to?
Absolutely. It's pawsinmotion.org, and that's our website. It's a little under construction still because we're incorporating, our new specialized. Oh, the other thing is we have 24-hour daycare. That's something else that we just started, which is becoming very, very popular. People can drop off their dogs at night
really?
For a couple hours while they go for dinner, and then, so the dogs don't have to be alone.
Oh.
Anyway, pawsinmotion.org, and the phone number for the daycare is 604-730-6948.
Wonderful. Thanks so much for that, Julia.
No problem, Mark.
I appreciate
you
coming on the show.
Thank you so much for our chance.
Oh, it's wonderful to hear about your activities and so on. We'll have a follow-up sometime later when we have a chance to get really established.
That's great. We will look forward to it.
Thanks again.
Thanks, Martha. Bye-bye.
Bye. You have been listening to an interview with Julia Pizaskis, who is with the Paws in Motion animal care business on Cornwall in Vancouver. Now, we're going to hear from John Pranger, who will cite some passages from a U.S. government document of hearings before a House of Representatives committee on the treatment of animals used in research. John?
Thanks, Marsh. Great interview. A French physician, Professor Maurice Delore, did some very plain talking at the inaugural session of the Académie de Bourges on December 16th of 1962, and he said, "Today's medicine is at the end of its road. It could no longer be transformed, modified, readjusted. That's been tried too often. Today's medicine must die in order to be reborn. We must prepare its complete renovation." That was 1962. Well, 40, 50 years later, it's still trotting along. Although, from the opening sentence of the book review of Medical Nemesis in Time magazine of June 28, 1976, Medical Nemesis being the book written by Ivan Illich, the great sociologist and author and researcher and medical historian, and he came to the conclusion that modern medicine does far more harm than good. And the opening sentence of this book review says, "With only a few notable exceptions, such as some senior official of the American Medical Association, almost everyone agrees that modern medicine is as sick as the patient it treats." Well, why is it so sick? Part of it is very much hidden behind locked doors and within the cages, and that is a false science which pretends to be enhancing the advancement of medicine and instead is retarding it. And the reason is pretty easy to find, I think, for anyone with a little bit of sense. And this 392-page volume published in 1962 by the United States government is oddly titled Humane Treatment of Animals Used in Research. And this is hearings before a subcommittee on interstate and foreign commerce, the House of Representatives. And there's a, I'll cite a few passages from it. Page 218, the testimonial is given that in any class of medical students, you can always spot a certain number with sadistic tendencies. And on page 250, a doctor testified that trying to produce convulsions in dogs is terrible. "I know they wouldn't let you see that, though. Shock experiments, removal of organs, blocking intestines, or the urine outlet so the bladder ruptures, are only run-of-the-mill. You'd be surprised to hear what professors and some students can think up. At night, I kept thinking about the dogs. Imagine, after you have had major surgery and you're between life and death, your little square of cold, drafty cement flooring is cleaned by having a hose of cold water squirted over you. The dogs are soaked in this cold water. Dogs right after recovering from surgery. No wonder most of the dogs die. If they live within a couple of days or a week, they're used for a different experiment. One dog survived seven experiments." On page 251, "I'm a young student studying veterinary medicine. I was never and am not now in the employ of any humane society. This is a cry and a plea from a young person still holding on to a few ideals I've grown to believe in, and I'm beginning to wonder if there is any real humane goodness among humans. I'm not a sentimentalist, a crusader, or a fanatic, but I cannot, under any code or way of human life, condone what I, in a few short years, have seen." On page 264, it says, "There is no check whatever upon the wasteful repetition of experiments for which the taxpayer pays. No checks on careless planning, no checks on the outright sadist who surrounds his real subconscious motive with a fog of scientific terms." And on page 311, this I've mentioned this one before, and it's such a shocker, but I've mentioned it to a friend, and he wouldn't believe that that was the case. I recently asked a young physician how the newer medical students can judge the need for sedatives if the dog has been devocalized, as the scientists phrase it, that is to say, has had its vocal cords cut. His answer was startling. He said, "It is the prevalent attitude in medical schools now that dogs can't feel pain. Dogs do not suffer." At page 346, I attended Chicago Medical School last September. I withdrew of my own accord. One of the conditions that led to my contempt towards the school was the cruel treatment which was given to the experimental animals. Well, the researchers tell us that everything is fine, not to worry. They have their ethics committees, and the animals don't suffer. Well, they must be blind to suffering if these testimonials have any weight.
Thanks for that, John. You are listening.
It's not on.
Sorry. Thank you, John. You are listening to CFRO 102.7 on your FM dial, and this is Animal Voices. Now, I'm going to call upon our engineer to play some music for us, please.
Spartacus Books is Vancouver's only volunteer-run non-profit radical bookstore and info shop. An alternative to the corporate mainstream, Spartacus carries material on anarchism, women's studies, ecology, labor and economics, race studies, queer lit, underground fiction, and much more. So come check out our cool new digs, complete with comfy couches and free internet and computer access. That's 319 West Hastings, upstairs above Vinyl Records.
I have a little announcement here from the Vancouver Humane Society newsletter about the exotics. It's an update for us on the issue in the city of Vancouver. Vancouver City Council has deferred consideration of a motion to ban exotic animals until the fall. City staff will produce a report for council on the issue, which will then be discussed by the Planning and Environment Committee. Vancouver Humane Society is encouraging the humane community in the city to make itself heard on the issue. The exotic pet industry and reptile clubs are expected to hotly contest any move towards a prohibition on the sale or ownership of exotic animals in the city. They have been deluging City Council with correspondence in an attempt to convince councillors that they should have the right to own the animals they choose. Vancouver Humane Society has provided scientific research to the council showing the exotic species suffer in captivity and are inappropriate as pets. So please make your wishes known to Mayor Sam Sullivan and to the council at the Vancouver City Hall. We need to put the pressure on to prevent the continuation of importing exotics and housing them. Thanks. Now, Carl has something for us.
Yes, Marge. You know, Lindsay Bickford was instrumental in getting this program, Animal Voices, going about 6 years ago. I'm happy to announce that if Lindsay had been here this week, he would have been a grandfather. So it would have been a very happy moment for him. And we share the joy of Ed and Roshi Bickford. But Lindsay was very fond of a friend, who Jamie Alexander, who joined Earth Safe Toastmasters at the age of about 15. And he's getting married this week, and what happened on Sunday. And one of the things that I went to his webpage, and I came across a wonderful little story that Jamie wrote, Jamie and Jamie getting married, and he wrote a history of my relationship with factory farming. And Jamie wrote, "Like most children, I knew nothing about the way in which farm animals are being treated. As children, we are shown picture books in which the animals are living happily on a farm with everything they could ever need or want available to them. We are told that they are happy to be able to help us by giving us food. We are not even told that they are killed, let alone the way in which they are killed, leaving us with a reassuring, although unspoken, sense that we only eat them after they've lived out their normal lifespans and died a natural death. For many people, this comforting illusion of idyllic farm life remains with them as they get older," Jamie writes. "It was a traumatic experience for me to discover through the reading that I did in grade 8 how terrible the lives of most farm animals today actually are. I tried to tell people about the abuses involved in factory farming, only to find that they appeared to care very little. It has now become clear to me that the problem may not have been a lack of concern, but that they may have been afraid of facing the truth about the horrors that lie behind the food that ends up on their dinner plates." Jamie writes, "Over time, as I read more and more material, my initial shock and outrage at factory farming slowly hardened into a feeling of quiet resentment and almost into a state of apathy at times. I became numb. I assume that the workers in factory in a factory farm or a slaughterhouse must go through a similar process of subduing their feelings of compassion in order to carry out their jobs and earn their meager living." And Jamie further writes in his last paragraph on his relationship with factory farming. He says, "However, what I had to realize is that just because I have often become desensitized to the conditions in which factory farmed animals are raised, it does not mean that the animals themselves have ceased to feel. They still suffer from the same acute pains and from the same misery caused by confinement and deprivation. Rather than becoming apathetic by repressing my feelings of sympathy," Jamie writes, "I've had to work at channeling these feelings into a compassion for improving the situation of these animals." And I can tell you that we're attending Jamie's wedding on Sunday, and it's going to be an all-vegan event in Stanley Park.
Sounds wonderful. That was lovely, Carl. Thank you for that. Now, Alan, do we have a piece of lively music? I see that we've got Dana Lyons right beside you there. And Dana's always so upbeat. Okay, any more comments?
Well, I am going to be talking about Seduced in a few moments. seduced as a was a participant in the Animal Voices Film Festival, and they have something very unique at this at their location on 1958 West 4th Avenue, because they provide smoothies and they're so popular, and it satisfies many of our health requirements, protein requirements, and we hopefully will be speaking to Oksana within a few minutes. So over to Alan and a little bit of music.
Won't you please take my friends on a wild, happy ride through that open countryside where it's so good to be alive, where the ocean meets the sand in our green, rainy land. Take this woman and this man for a wild, happy ride. Well, if anyone's to blame, it's old Saddam Hussein. They met at a peace dance in the war. They built a little shack with the forest just out back, and that's where they learned what love is for. Whoa, won't you please take my friends on a wild, happy ride through that open countryside where it's so good to be alive, where the ocean meets the sand in our green, rainy land. Take this woman and this man for a wild, happy ride. Well, someone said to me, hey, life ain't just easy. There's ups and downs and things that can go wrong. There's wars, disease, and death, credit cards and morning breath. Those nights the playoffs won't come in on your TV. Oh, won't you please take my friends on a wild, happy ride through that open countryside where it's so good to be alive, where the ocean meets the sand in our green, rainy land. Take this woman and this man for a wild, happy ride. In old times we roamed the land, hunter-gatherer clans. We shared the jobs and joys of this good life. Now we're your family and your close community. You should always call on us when you need help. Whoa, won't you please take my friends on a wild, happy ride through that open countryside where it's so good to be alive, where the ocean meets the sand in our green, rainy land. Take this woman and this man for a wild, happy ride. You have so many friends, may your laughter never end, may the rising river never reach your house, may you dance all night long to that sweet romantic song, may you always have a crush upon your spouse. Oh, won't you please take my friends on a wild, happy ride through that open countryside where it's so good to be alive, where the ocean meets the sand in our green, rainy land. Take this woman and this man for a wild, happy ride. Oh, won't you please take my friends for a wild, happy ride through that open countryside where it's so good to be alive, where the ocean meets the sand. Happy ride, take this woman and this man for a wild, happy ride.
Nice lively piece you played. Now I'm going to read a little story while we're waiting for our next interviewee on the telephone, and it's from Chicken Soup for Cat and Dog Lovers' Souls, and it's by a veterinarian named Marty Becker. It's called Killer Angels. I had just graduated from veterinary school, and I was volunteering at the local shelter in Twin Falls, Idaho. As I looked down at the dog napping in her run, I knew I was going to have to wake her up to put her to sleep. What a cruel euphemism. She was a Heinz 57 mixed breed with no name, no home, no hope. She was horrifically malnourished, and her coat was a mass of mats and burrs. In a way, she was lucky to be here. Found on the side of the road like living garbage, she'd been left to die in a remote area of our country.
The kind rancher who found her brought her to the local shelter, where she joined dozens of other cuties and uglies pressing up against the front of the cages, hoping to catch the eye of someone who had a heart and home big enough to give them another chance. Problem was, there were too many homeless pets and not enough homes. Day after day for a week, the dog waited and waited, her still wagging tail marking the time. But on this day, her time was up. No one had adopted her. Like many in the shelter, the animals were too big, too small, too hairy, too young, too old. Without enough cages to hold all that came through their doors, we were prepared to end her life quickly and without suffering. Better than starving to death in the country, I said, finding little solace in the words. I was inspired to enter this profession because of a deep love of animals. I had been highly trained and entrusted to save lives and prevent pain and suffering. Yet here was I, about to end the life of this innocent creature. I hated this part of the job, but I had to do it. Choking back my emotions, I readied myself to perform the procedure for which I had been trained. I set her on the table, and she wiggled her gaunt frame with delight as I spoke some soothing words and patted her head. The tempo of her tail quickened as she looked up at my face. Looking into her eyes, I saw total trust, unconditional love, and absolute loyalty. I felt the cruel irony of what was taking place. God's precious creatures, embodying the kindest virtues on the planet, being killed for the crime of not being wanted. She held out her leg for me to inject and licked my hand. She was ready. I wasn't. I collapsed into the dog and held her tight until I bathed her with tears. Never, ever would I do a convenience euthanasia again. I'd euthanize a pet if it were suffering terribly or had an incurable disease, but never again because of an uncaring owner's mere request. I took the dog back to my veterinary practice and named her G.H., good for good home. I'd observed over the years that people who raise litters of puppies or kittens always said, "I just want to find them a good home." I soon entrusted G.H. to a loving client who had a heart and home big enough to welcome yet another four-legged family member. Saving G.H. set me on a new path as a veterinarian. Although my hands still held the power of death, my heart didn't. Now, whenever I look into the dancing liquid eyes of a pet brimming with love, I realize that looks can save. They did me.
Yes, Marge, and on the line we have Emily Doyle Yamaguchi, and she's from the Faculty of Land and Food Systems at UBC. And I met her at the World Urban Forum at Canada Place. Welcome, Emily.
Hi, how are you?
Good. You know, you're doing such wonderful work up at UBC. We're looking at this World Forum was about sustainable living, and you're promoting sustainable food. So maybe you can tell us what you're doing.
Well, basically, I'm working with a group of students from UBC to help them promote urban agriculture as a solution to rapid urbanization.
Right. And how are you doing that?
Well, what we've done is we were fortunate enough to get some funding from the Environmental Youth Alliance, who have been very, very supportive, and International Development and Research Canada to come and be here today and exhibit at three different sites. So what we decided to do, since it's pretty easy for us to be here since we all live in Vancouver, is try and act as a voice for those who couldn't make it here today. And the three exhibits that we have, the first is about international success stories in urban agriculture, because the world is just full of amazing, amazing stories. And the other two are more about technical solutions to specific problems like lack of clean water or lack of space for growing. And we just found really simple ways to address these issues.
Now, cities are getting bigger and bigger, and the environmental footprint is larger and larger.
Mm-hmm.
So how are you going about that?
Well, it's a pretty complicated problem, and I'm sure you'll agree, but I think that urban agriculture is something that people are starting to realize is a really practical solution to these problems. I mean, one great thing about this forum is that it's being brought up time and time again by different levels of participants, so government, federal, local, grassroots, NGOs, members of the public, And I mean, it's not so much that urban agriculture is a new concept. People have been producing food for themselves in their own backyards or on their balconies for a long time. And I mean, urban agriculture really extends to so many different kinds of activities, including rainwater harvesting or composting, that it's just not limited to the rural landscape. So it's something that is easily undertaken by anybody anywhere. And so the fact that people are realizing this and talking about it and recognizing it as legitimate use of urban space is a really great thing. So that's, it's kind of, you know, spreading the gospel, I like to say.
Now, you say grow your own. And when you see, because people in Vancouver are quite meticulous about their lawns, would you like to see them planting potatoes instead of lawns? I mean, what are you suggesting here?
Well, you know, I mean, it's hard because people have different values about what land should look like, about what nature means, about what city means, about what country means. And, you know, I understand that people want well-manicured lawns because it's something that they feel is beautiful. But what we're saying is that you can have something beautiful that also has function. And so you can transform that park space that's just trees and grass. I love trees, but I mean, you can't eat trees. into a community garden. You can turn it into a space where you have living fences with strawberries planted in a pallet wall or with raspberry bushes, you know, to help and enclose the area and keep out all the noise and pollution. So there's tons of innovative ways that you can integrate urban agriculture even into an aesthetic space. Now, of course, a golf course is a different story, but who's to say that you couldn't have some fruit trees on the sidelines, you know?
Right. The other thing is that we have so many plants that are aromatic, like rosemary and lavender, and they also... You know, charred plants, many of them, you have this red charred plants. They're beautiful.
Yeah,
and,
exactly.
And plants, one can incorporate them to be a delight for the eye.
Exactly. And, I mean, another really great example is scarlet runner beans. They're just absolutely spectacular. They grow to be enormous lengths, and they produce these beautiful bright red flowers. But you can also eat the fruit which they bear, or the vegetable, that is, which is the beans. So, yeah, I mean, there's no reason why you can't have all these things in your own small space, whichever or whatever that may be.
So also the aspect of, I see you had at solstice celebration of bees, which is so important for the fertilization of the fruit trees. And now Vancouver has, does it have a meaningful legislation to control people spraying pesticides?
You know, I don't really know about the legislation concerning pesticides. I know that it's becoming increasingly unfashionable to use chemical fertilizers and pesticides because integrated pest management, that is using natural solutions to controlling pests, is becoming more well known. But what you're saying about the bees, yeah, that's a good point. I mean, there's an example of how insects are a really important part of that agricultural community. And a lot of people have divorced themselves from that. We forget that it is a community, that everyone has a role to play, ourselves, the plants, the animals. We all have something to do with it. And that's actually something that I'm going to be teaching a group of inner-city youth this summer as part of the KidSafe program, which helps to foster positive activities for children in at-risk inner-city communities, is that, you know, every one of these things has an important role to play. And in terms of the bees, I mean, without bees, we wouldn't have fruit because they pollinate. And you think about that honey on the toast that you ate this morning for breakfast. You know, they produce that as well. So it's not just things that sting and bite. I mean, we sting and bite too, if provoked. So.
Now, what a wonderful way to educate the children who might otherwise think, you know, everything comes from the superstore.
Yeah.
Or they get to see the small plant, the different stages it goes through. Sometimes it's vulnerable, which plants are doing well and which are not. And, you know, the whole management of it is an act of love.
Exactly. And actually, one great place where this education is happening is the UBC Farm, which is also called the Center for Sustainable Land Management. I'm sorry, the name just changed, but it is the UBC Farm, and it's out on South Campus in Point Grey. And it's actually a student initiative that emerged, I think, about 8 years ago when a student recognized that this land was at risk of being developed and needed to be proven to be a really important resource. So at this point, they have numerous programs and courses that are using this site for experiential learning. They have a schools program where people from different generations come together and learn from one another using the garden. They also have cultural gardens for the Vancouver Mayan community and the Musqueam Nation. They also have a community kitchen and garden program for downtown Eastside residents. So there's a whole host of events happening there, and they've been super supportive of us through the whole time. So I just really wanted to mention them and extend my gratitude to all their support.
So now, Emily, the public can become involved in your project, which is the Faculty of Land and Food Systems at UBC. Now, you said that you're on Point Grey.
Yeah.
That's up at UBC, is it?
Yeah, and actually, you're right. There's a whole range of opportunities for volunteers to get involved.
How do they contact you?
Well, I am not employed by the farm, but the farm has a website, and I gave that to you, but I'll just read it out. If anybody's listening, it's www.landfood.ubc.ca/UBC Farm. You can also just Google it, and it's sure to pop up. There's tons of stuff. You can volunteer at the summer camp that they have there for a week. You can also come down and just check out the produce at the Saturday farm markets from 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. Or you can even help harvest the food that's going to be sold on Friday afternoons.
Yum. Now, we hear a bit of background there, and I'd like to remind people that I met you at the World Urban Forum at Canada Place. And what is it? You've been there for much of the week, and what has it meant to you to be there? What kind of questions are people asking you?
You know, I feel really honored to be here, truly. It sounds a little cheesy, but it's the truth. I have spent the last 5 months working with other volunteers to prepare for this, and finally being here has really opened my eyes to the truth and the necessity of using urban agriculture to help and address some of these problems. People have been coming to our booths who are from all over the world, from Kampala in Uganda, in Japan, from the United States, from different communities in the Vancouver region, all of whom are interested in urban agriculture, who have heard these words but aren't really sure how to apply them. And so I feel like it's been a really good opportunity for all of us to connect as a community of people interested in, you know, I guess acting on our right to produce our own food that is nutritious and safe and create really good, strong communities with strong social fabrics.
So the World Urban Forum has been quite meaningful for you, but you know, right next to Canada Place, they're building a gigantic new convention center there, and they're going to have a rooftop garden covering the entire area. Have you had any input into that? Will they be growing herbs and veggies there for consumption at the convention center?
I really don't know. See, this is an example of the way that urban agriculture is just taking off in Canadian cities like Vancouver and Montreal and Toronto, is that, you know, there's so many things happening, people just taking initiative to act on this, that we can't even keep track of it all. I actually just found out through one of the sessions, Peter Ladner came and spoke, telling us about the different initiatives happening around Vancouver, is that one new condominium being built around English Bay, I think, or just off of Howe Street, will be incorporating a rooftop garden as part of its infrastructure. So kind of like a sauna room, except a rooftop garden. So I think that's just fabulous, you know?
Well, we're moving in the right direction, and of course we're so privileged to live in Vancouver, whereas the prospect of cities getting bigger everywhere would actually mean more slums, people living in closer confinement with less facilities. But here in Vancouver, what we're saying is that this can be planned, and this is what I believe the Urban Forum was all about, is to to solve these problems of people in such large quantities moving from the urban areas to the from the rural areas to the urban areas.
Definitely.
Anyway, I thank you for being on Animal Voices, and congratulate you for your work at UBC and at the forum.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. We've been speaking to Emily Doyle Yamaguchi, and over to Marge.
Thank you, Carl. Most interesting interview. There was a write-up, and I'm sure you're familiar with it, in the Vancouver Sun by Stephen Hume, talking about the World Urban Forum. I found it scary because it talked about how the slums in major cities are growing tremendously, and as the population grows, the slums grow. Could you refer to that, please?
Yes, you know, Stephen Hume, he says that we are the richest civilization in all of human history, and we can't get our collective foreign aid contributions much above 0.5% of gross domestic product without pleading, we're just donating such a small percentage of our wealth to sharing it with this abject poverty and the growth of slums in so many African and Asian countries.
Yes, he talked about Harare and the dismal conditions as far as toilet facilities. What, 1,300 people in one section of a slum using a latrine with six holes, and that was their facility, so that you can imagine how the terrible bacteria and deadly diseases would be circulating among people in such conditions. And, of course, water would be another major problem, wouldn't it?
Yes, Marge, he also writes about that in spite of fertility rates declining, the population is not. Population is still going up, and that we have to deal with the situation in by the year 2012. We're going to be having some, is it $7 billion on planet Earth, 7 billion people on planet Earth, and how are we going to cope? So, and it much of it rests with the trend that is happening at this stage of mega cities. You know, and he quotes that in previous times, the number of people that used to live in London was the same number of people that lived in the entire world.
Right.
And,
yeah.
And now, of course, these mega cities, Mexico City, in China, you don't even know the names of these cities.
When I was a child, the figure that stuck in my head was 2.5 billion people. And now we've got almost 7 billion people. You know, this article, I believe, is based on a UN report that Stephen Hume refers to. But it works on the assumption that people do not have the possibility of controlling their own behavior and the intelligence to understand what the future looks like if we keep reproducing at the rate we are today. Isn't population control a huge a factor that should be considered and dealt with?
Now, you know, the University of Chicago put out a study which was, to my mind, very remarkable. It said, when we're looking at the footprint which we're leaving in the world, our ecological footprint, it was better to become a vegan than to buy a hybrid vehicle. Mm-hmm. And so that's quite remarkable. But also, when we look at agriculture, you know, agriculture is, to my mind, so much a part of the problem. John talked about animal experimentation. On this program, we deal so often with what we're doing is we're growing all these animals. We're growing so much crops. 80% of the soya we grow, 90% of the corn we grow, we feed to chickens, we feed it to animals, and then we eat the animals. Plus, in order to sustain the animals, we're feeding them antibiotics, growth hormones, all kinds of other, growth accelerators. And we believe that Dr. Michael Clapper, he always used to come to Vancouver, and he used to say, well, he has a little magic grinder, and it takes 16 pounds of grain to make 1 pound of beef. Well, if you took that 16 pounds of grain, you would be able to feed many, many people with bread from that that 16 pounds. Whereas 1 pound of animal flesh is not that all that much, and it may not all be that good for you.
Yes, but that still means that we are going to continue increasing our numbers. There is a finite number of people that can be supported under any method of use of resources on the earth, and we are gobbling them all. Other species are diminishing in number and just being wiped off the face of the earth. I think people have to look at themselves and say, there are too many. We have to control our population. And there's no reason why that can't be done as well as all these other things, don't you think?
Right. How many minutes do we have left here? We're coming to the end of the program. 1 minute.
1 minute to go.
And I always love our little statement of what we're all about, especially with celebrating Ed Bickford and Roshi's baby, their baby born being today, that animal voices in this program. Lindsay Bickford would have been pleased to know that we still continue to enlighten in many ways the general public about so many animal-related causes. And we hope we do this by presenting programs that delivers a message that inspires people, like it's inspired Jamie, whose letter we read today, to improve the lives of animals. And in this day, we're dedicated to exposing and challenging many of what people don't want to know is being perpetrated every day by our society against billions of innocent, sentient, non-human animals.
You are listening to CFRO 102.7 FM, Co-op Radio in Vancouver. This is Animal Voices, and thank you for listening. Please tune in again next week at 12 noon. Good afternoon.
Our webpage is www.animalvoices.org, and our webmaster, John Pranger, he posts many of our programs there. So thank you, Alan Jensen, for being in the controls.